This is an ABC podcast. This is the WA Country Hour with Belinda Varischetti on ABC Radio WA.
Good afternoon to you. Today, a Darwin-based critical minerals company has plans to harness Ord River hydropower to open the only commercial fluorite mine in the country, and it had set that up just southwest of Kununurra. More about those plans after news headlines at 12:30 today. Before we get to those headlines today, we will be taking a look at the Dry Season Task Force, which is meeting for the second time tomorrow, and it wants to hear from you. And the way to do that is through a survey, which has been out for a little while now, but you now have an extra week to complete this survey. And it's important that you do it, because this is really going to shape the assistance and the support for farmers going forward. Basically, the information that you fill out in that survey will be fed straight through to the Dry Season Task Force. So I have some details on that for you shortly. 12:06. Speaking of the weather, for most Western Australian farmers, rain is the only topic of conversation today. Grain growers lucky enough to get some rain are probably saying, well, that's great, but it's nowhere near enough. And you'll hear just after 12:30 today, so many locations receiving less than 5 millimetres in the gauge. But Daryl Smith grows potatoes and runs cattle and sheep near Busselton in WA's southwest. And it is safe to say he has a smile on his face right now.
We're looking forward to the rain. We've sort of seen a weather forecast saying it might be coming, but sometimes weather forecasts are right and sometimes they're wrong. But when it started raining, there was a little bit less than we thought we were going to get. A bit disappointed, but when we got up this morning, it's been all good since then.
How much did you get?
So we've now, since yesterday, we've now had 44 millimetres.
44?
Yeah, 24 millimetres in the last 3 hours.
Wow. What does that amount of rain mean to you?
Well, I grow potatoes. Yesterday I had 6 diesel pumps running, 1 electric one, 3 submersible bores. I don't know how much energy they use. They're all off today and they'll be off for a few days. All the cows that are, they're still skinny. They'll be hungry today, but in a week or so's time, there'll be some feed growing for them, which is a real relief.
Roughly how many hectares do you have, and what percentage of that would be for spuds and what percentage would be as pasture?
We've got about 30 hectares of potatoes in, and the other 400-odd is pasture.
So you wouldn't have had much pasture. I mean, you wouldn't have had any rain since, around about October last year, would you?
I think Cape Naturalist has had 1.5 millimetres since the 4th of October. It's nothing. Yeah. The kaiku is dying. Everything was dying, yeah. And the paddocks are bare.
So when you say you were using the diesel to be actually irrigating, where were you getting your water from?
We're pumping from we've got one gully dam and 3 or 4 underground soaks, and then we've got bores that go down into the Leadville Aquifer, which is about 300 feet down.
And were they starting to get dry, or were they still operating?
One potato crop has basically just about died. We'd run out of water in one paddock. Yeah. So, but this will liven it up again a bit.
I bet it will. If you've been irrigating for that long, that must have substantially increased your costs.
That's it. Yeah. Like, every day when you're running that number of pumps, you're probably using $400 or $500 worth of energy each day.
Yeah.
Just in diesel or electricity or whatever way you want to call it, plus the labour to do it.
Yeah, that's huge. And if you're not feeding your livestock, your cattle and your sheep with the pasture, you're bringing it in, you're buying it in?
Yeah, so this year we've had to buy hay for the first time ever that I can remember, and it was pretty expensive. And we'd be buying grain for the sheep. We've got lambs that we can't sell, so they're on grain as well. So it's been been a tough year.
I bet it has. Just out of interest, where are you up to with your spud season?
Oh, we're only about 2 or 3 weeks from harvest now. Yeah. The earlier ones, and then they go for another couple of months after that.
So for the actual spuds themselves, is this good news, this rain?
Yeah, oh, absolutely. Yeah, no, there's nothing like rain. You can irrigate as much as you like, but all this rain will bring in, you know, it drags a bit of nutrition out of the atmosphere as it comes down too. So,
what's the market looking like when you do harvest your spuds?
Look, the market, it looks like it might be a little bit short, to be honest, for a couple of months. So it might be a good market to sell into.
The stars might be aligning for once.
Perhaps. It might be a train at the end of a tunnel coming at us too.
I've had a quick look at the forecast for your area, and it says very good chance of rain for today and tomorrow. So you might have a bit more on the way.
Maybe. Like, it's what we've had is, yeah, it's sensational. It's just, it takes a weight off your shoulders. You sort of get a bit of stress and that sort of stuff, worrying about how you're going to feed your cows and the animals that you're responsible for. So it, it lightens that up a little bit. So now, yeah.
Well, Daryl, you've made my day as well. I'm hoping you can go out and give some of your sheep and your cattle a bit of a pat on the nose, and I reckon they'll be smiling as well.
Oh, they will be, yeah. Well, we know there's some grass coming. We sort of, you've got to keep rationing what you've got, but now you know there's some grass coming, you can sort of maybe give them a little extra too, make them happy.
Has the water started to put some into your dams as well? Or not yet?
Oh, no, it won't. They won't get affected by it much at all. Yeah. But it just means we're not pumping out of them for 3 or 4 days. This is probably 3 or 4 days, 5 days of irrigation now. So, yeah, it's cost.
Well, great news anyway, Daryl, and I hope you have a fantastic day today and more rain tomorrow.
Thanks very much, Richard.
Good on you.
And I hope everybody else gets the same, mate. Yeah.
Lovely to hear some of that. Happy rain news this afternoon. Daryl Smith, who farms about 20 kilometres southwest of Busselton in the state's southwest, he was talking to Richard Hudson about that glorious rain that he's had at least 24 mils, and that was just this morning. 12 past 12 here on the Country Hour. A former head of Western Australia's Potato Growers Association says deregulation of the industry has not benefited shoppers or family farmers as promised. It's 8 years since WA's potato industry was deregulated, and at the time it was predicted the shake-up would bring cheaper prices and also more choice. But on today's morning show, Ross Taylor explained why that hasn't happened.
Inevitably, with both sides of Parliament and the business community saying, with some degree of credibility, it was time to deregulate this industry. My job was to try and get it done in a way that it would preserve this very valuable asset that I think we did have, and that was family growers in the country areas. These are families that are the basis for so many of our rural communities. That, okay, we have to deregulate the industry, but how can we do this in a way that we can preserve the family grower? And I think in that regard, we failed quite badly.
So, do we have more varieties?
No, we don't. Not at all. And we knew during the deregulation process, former Labor stalwart Ron Edwards was the chair of the Potato Marketing Board, very, very articulate, smart man. Ron was very clear that there was almost too many varieties back then. But, of course, you know, our leader of the opposition, and it's fair enough in politics, he doesn't want to use that because he was after Colin Barnett. So what ended up, of course, was the Liberal Party under this enormous pressure, with jokes being made and certain very predominant growers using it as a massive marketing campaign for himself, which he did very well. It was a rush to get this deregulated, and I think we've had the consequences. So to answer your question, we had 24 varieties before deregulation. The public just never saw them, and now we have the same. And they still predominantly don't see them because it's controlled by, as I said in the paper today, basically now we've moved from government regulation to a private cartel between supermarkets and three of the major grower washpackers.
And that's what we're seeing. And so then on that point, what about the price point?
What we saw back then was around about $4 per kilo was a fair sort of price. So back then it was probably $3 to $4 was a reasonable price. And the promise of deregulation, of course, would be that the industry would have to restructure itself, move to bigger farms, which economically makes sense, but that would harm local growers, but that's basically what's happened. So through economies of scale, the cost to produce spuds was argued that it would come down, and it did. There's only one problem. The consumer hasn't seen that because it's the middleman now that is now making more, and I include the retailers, are making a bigger profit by just holding the price same to the consumer. And the one that's really, really got screwed is the smaller growers, and they have fallen out really, really badly, Nadia.
Because we've seen that there's been a bit of an exodus, hasn't there, from the potato industry?
Well, just an example, if you look in the Vass, in the Busselton region, which is not the main one, it's more down in Manjimup, but it's a pretty good size spud-growing area. So 8 years ago, we had 15 family-owned farmers in that area, and you know, I could name you six or seven young blokes following in dad's footsteps, aged 30. You know, very, very good, well-run businesses. Today in Vass, we had five, so that's about almost a 70% loss of those families to that to that industry. Some of them have moved out, and others have moved, just simply sold their properties, or as they have done in the Manjimup area, moved to in the field of avocado. And you saw what happened by that being done in an uncoordinated way. We almost ended up in with an oversupply of avocado. So the loss to the potato industry goes beyond just spuds. It also affects communities, because these are the people that have got kids that go to schools and families. So the long-term consequences of what was a very rushed deregulation by the Barnett government, as they felt the heat of a very effective opposition leader in Mark McGowan, has been quite serious. And that's why I think it's important for us to just highlight the fact, not that deregulation was bad, I think it had to happen, but certainly the way it was done was not good, and the consequences for our farming community and the consumer have been certainly disappointing.
And it feels like we can't really rectify that situation now, because, as you said, the power's now gone to the supermarkets, and people are reminding me, and I remember the debate well, when Tony Gallati giving away free potatoes. Remember that? That was his protest to having this industry deregulated. So what do we do?
Yeah, that's right. And you know, I dealt with Tony, and he's a very effective operator. And my career was based on I'm a marketing person by nature. I think his campaign, and I don't mean this facetiously at all, his campaign in terms of the deregulation, in terms of the promotion of his business, which is a great WA success story, was absolutely fantastic. He did that well, and really didn't cost him anything. So that was. That was a great outcome. But what I guess my concern is, going back to I mentioned about Vass, Nadia, we have a situation where now, without naming the growers, just in that area alone in the last 3 months, we have a number of growers that have just taken, and these are grade one potatoes that they've grown, have just ploughed them back into the ground. Yeah. Because The cartel say, look, you know, we need to keep the prices where they are. We only want a certain supply. Or in other words, almost duplicating what the regulation board did, but instead of a government control, this is just a private, as I use the word, cartel. And it's just when you see perfectly good potatoes being just ploughed back into the ground, and that's the farmer saying, well, there goes my crop. And that family suffers badly, because they've done all the planting costs, and all the harvesting costs, and now they just bury them. And I think that's a reflection of not bad government policy in deregulating, but by not doing it in a systematic way with industry that we wanted at the time, and the consequences are now playing out behind the scenes. And I thought it was time that people should understand that.
So interesting, just to reflect back on that time, that debate about the deregulation of the WA potato industry and where we are today. That's the former head of WA's Potato Growers Association, Ross Taylor, speaking earlier today to Nadia Mitsopoulos. And if you've got some thoughts, something to add to that conversation, please do on the text 0448 922 604. It is 19 past 12.
The Country Hour with Belinda Varaschetti on ABC Local Radio WA.
Of course, we'll get to the news headlines and a look at the weather around Western Australia around about 12:30 today. First, though, WA sheep and cattle producers now have an extra week to respond to a seasonal and market conditions survey that will be passed directly back to the Dry Season Task Force. Sheep Producers Australia, Cattle Australia and Western Dairy say producers now have until next Wednesday, that's the 8th of May, to complete the survey. Bonnie Skinner is the CEO of Sheep Producers Australia. She says the information that you provide in this survey is critical to help inform the right assistance and support for WA producers.
The questions in the survey extend to beyond just feed and fodder availability. It's just to understand exactly what the current situation is on farm. So feed availability, water availability, what sort of management decisions people are undertaking, what access to options that, you know, they've got to turn off stock. So all that information will be provided to the task force. And we've had a really strong response to the survey to date. We've had a few requests now from producers, just given their time constraints with what they're managing on farm, to have a little bit more time to feed into that survey process. So we were going to close the survey off at the end of today. We've extended that by another week. So the survey will remain open until next Wednesday, but we will do an initial report up to the task force this Friday.
It's a time-sensitive problem for a lot of people who don't have food and water for their animals. With the results provided to the task force on Friday, is it likely that they'll start acting on the information that they have from that meeting, or are they going to wait until the final survey results are in the following week before they start acting on those results?
My understanding was that they will start acting on those results immediately. It's really important information that needs to inform government decisions around this, and certainly the announcement from government last week was welcome in terms of the scope of the funding. We've asked people in a survey explicitly what sort of help they need from government and what the task force should be requesting. So that data is going to be very much used to inform future deliberations by the task force and advice up to the government. And I think that it's been a really important mechanism, because a lot of this is happening on farm, and this has provided a vital link to be able to inform the government correctly. So very valuable use of people's time in completing this survey.
Anecdotally, have you been hearing from producers in the state, and what have they been telling you?
You know, as an organisation, we have been working across this issue for a long time, and certainly those conditions on farm and the feedback that we've been getting from producers has certainly been heightened in the last couple of months. But I have to say, you know, in terms of exacerbated market conditions and limited options for producers to turn their stock off, we have been looking to talk to government about that, and have been talking about government about that for the last 12 to 18 months. It's certainly heightened. I think there are, you know, a lot of producers who are very well adapted and have resilience within their business systems to deal with dry seasonal conditions. But really what we're seeing is that these ongoing dry conditions have exacerbated the market conditions. So a lot of people are feeling very frustrated. They're feeling a little bit hopeless. I think they're feeling that this season has been tougher than previous seasons they've experienced before. And a lot of the calls that we're getting is just frustration at any intervention at a market level. They just want markets to be able to sell their sheep into.
With the task force being established at the beginning of autumn, do you feel that that should have been a decision that was maybe brought forward or established closer to or during that hotter, drier summer in anticipation of these events carrying over?
Yeah, I mean, I can't speak to what might have been instigated within the department at the time around summer on this. Certainly producers have been on high alert themselves, and many have strategies in place for late break conditions and what needs to be done around destocking. We've seen very much a shift in government policy with regards to drought response away from, you know, short-term emergency kind of responses to longer-term ways to build resilience within people's farming systems. And that's what a lot of producers want to be able to do. I think a lot of people have seasonal strategies to deal with prolonged dry seasonal conditions, but we've got the situation of current market conditions, which are making it really difficult for people to move certain classes of stock off their farm. So, yeah, I think, you know, in hindsight, when you're looking at these situations, acting sooner rather than later is always the best thing that you can do. But I'm sure the task force will be looking at learnings from this season to inform what happens in the future.
There's been a little bit of rain across the south and the southwest of the state this morning, and there's going to be more on Thursday morning. Is that going to be a relief to producers, that small amount, or is it effectively the proverbial drop in the bucket?
Yeah, I spoke to a few people this morning that were very excited at that prospect of rain, but unfortunately it's already sort of passed over their place and they were pretty disappointed. I mean, I think rain and what we observed certainly nationally last year with the downturn in the sheep industry, rain inspires a lot of confidence. But I think in this situation, you know, the forecasts are talking about a break to occur perhaps around mid to late May. It's not going to address the market conditions that we know that are existing within the Western Australian sheep industry at the moment. So, yes, I think it always helps to lift confidence to a certain extent. But there are people who are obviously in situations now with limited feed availability, limited water availability and limited turnoff options that need help right now.
Bonnie Skinner, she's the CEO of Sheep Producers Australia. She was speaking to Andrew Chounding. Sheep Producers Australia board director and woodnilling producer Bindi Murray actually sits on the dry season task force. And as I mentioned earlier, it's going to be meeting for the second time tomorrow. It meets fortnightly. So this is really important to get your story through to the task force. The best way to do that is via that survey. It is easy to find. I've done it myself. Well, not filled out the survey, but gone to find where the survey is. Just go online to Sheep Producers Australia's website, and right at the top of the page, there's a link to the survey. So it is really simple. Just go to Sheep Producers Australia website and you'll see it right at the top there. This on the text from Peter in Albany. Belinda, I've already answered the survey, but is there a way to message the task force or are they siloed? Peter, I think, you know, it's great that you've done the survey, but maybe if you contact one of those industry groups, if you've got more information to pass on or ideas or something like that, perhaps that is the best way to go about that. So if you're a cattle producer, Cattle Australia or one of the lobby groups, something like that is probably the best course of action to get that message through. 27 past 12. Well, southern cattle producers who are experiencing one of their driest seasons on record are being advised to recalculate their stock feed requirements. Dr. Danny Roberts is a veterinary officer at the Department of Primary Industries and Regional Development. He says sometimes it's good to go back to basics when you're experiencing a season like no other.
A lot of cattle producers along the south coast, on the west coast, have experienced very little rain over summer, which is very unusual for them. And basically, the cattle have eaten all the pasture that's available. So therefore, we're just trying to provide some thought processes into feed budgeting.
There have been dry season advice for sheep producers, so why come out with advice for cattle producers now? What's got to that point? What are conditions looking like?
There's virtually no feed out there in paddocks, no pasture, and water's becoming very limited on farms. Certainly experienced dry seasons before, but quite often the get out of jail card was the germination that usually occurs by now, and it hasn't. And it's looking not likely to occur for some time in May. So it's a long period of feed, and perhaps they haven't had as much feed on hand given the lack of feed available for a longer period.
So I suppose for this situation, it is a little bit more unusual, and thinking about the requirements that cattle need may be something that perhaps farmers haven't done for some time. So where do they start?
Well, we do have a web page, and on that page there are some links to different information sources. One of the links is a drought calculator or a dry season calculator that cattle producers can use. It was developed by the New South Wales DPI, but it is one that can be used for cattle producers. And basically what it's asking you in a feed budget, it says, well, what do those cattle need? So if they were calving on the 1st of April, they're lactating now, or start to, many of them are lactating, then what do they need to remain above, not slipping below condition score 2 within the next month? That's the sort of thinking you have to do. And what are they getting from the pasture? Well, not a lot. They're obviously losing weight. and then you've got certain feeds that you can feed them. And this calculator allows you to examine the rate of feeding that you need to provide those animals to prevent excessive weight loss. And honestly sit down and do some feed budgeting, not just hope what you're feeding them is adequate. So one of the things, if you're feeding a bale stubble, you may find that those animals can't eat enough in one day to extract enough energy, and so they'll be losing weight, where reasonable hay may be okay. So one of the things you can do is, for example, is to test the product you're feeding them to make sure that the product will provide the outcome that you're seeking.
DPIRD's Dr. Danny Roberts speaking to Tara de Landgraaf. And you can find those resources online, and, you know, there's a whole heap of information there for you. Sort of click on links and take you where you want to go, the information you need, including that feed calculator that Danny was talking about. Go online, search DPIRD dry season information, and it should come up as the number one listed on the web page there. So search DPIRD dry season information, and really there's some good information there for you if you are in that sort of situation. It is 12:30. Jonathan Beale in the studio with the headlines.
Oh, thanks, Belinda. I don't actually have the headlines here. I've brought the weather in me with
me.
Oh,
we do the weather next. We do the weather next, Jonathan.
I don't want to give you that. We don't want to double up on the weather. Can I come back?
Come back. We'll go to the weather first. Jonathan Beale just really keeping you in suspense while he goes and gets the actual information that we really need with the news headlines. Still to come here on the Country Hour, we'll head off to Mount Barker for the results of the cattle market. I think it's Tracy Kilner along with the details of that, the yarding and the prices for you. And also shortly, just taking you to Kununurra, we're going to catch up with rural reporter Alice Marshall. And she's going to tell you about this Darwin-based critical minerals company, Tivan, which has plans to harness Ord River hydropower and open the only commercial fluorite mine in the country. And its plan is to set that up just southwest of Kununurra. Alice will be along shortly to go through the details of that. It is 28-1 here on the Country Hour, and we're mixing things up today. Oh, no, he's back. That was quick. I wonder if you've got your breath, Jonathan. Do you?
I just had to go to the studio next door where they kindly printed off a copy of the headlines for me.
Oh, they're so good.
All right. In the headlines, Belinda, the Premier Roger Cook has expressed concern about the apparent disappearance of two Perth brothers during a surfing trip in Mexico. Jake and Callum Robertson haven't been in touch with family since the weekend. In a social media post, their mother said they were travelling in the Baja region. Mr. Cook says it's a worrying situation. The Jewish Community Council of WA has questioned pro-Palestinian protesters at Curtin University. Hundreds of students rallied yesterday calling for Curtin to cut ties with weapons manufacturers linked to Israel and to divest itself from all Israeli businesses. The council says the protesters are emulating Columbia University students whose demonstrations have descended into an anti-Semitic riot. And WA's health minister has slammed what she calls a misleading and dishonest campaign regarding a remote hospital in the Pilbara. An upgrade at Tom Price's hospital was first promised in 2021, but the government's had difficulty attracting a contractor for the project. A Shire of Ashburton media campaign says the hospital's infrastructure and services are so outdated they're a danger to patients. Amber Jade Sanderson says there's no evidence to back up those claims. More news, Belinda, at 1.
Smooth as. Thank you, Jonathan. Appreciate that. 27-1.
You're part of the Country Hour with Belinda Varaschetti on ABC Local Radio WA.
Great to have you along today. We will head off to the Bureau in just a moment. I just want to tell you, though, because this news has just come through. In a pre-budget announcement, the state government has just revealed that about $26 million is going to be allocated to tackle some biosecurity threats. So about $16.5 million will help fund biosecurity responses to certain plant and animal pests and diseases over the next 3 years. So that's going to help tackle things like the Queensland fruit fly and the destructive Polyphagus shothole borer, which is having a huge impact on Perth's tree canopy. Another $6.8 million is going to be allocated in the budget to upgrade DPIRD's border facilities at Eucla and Kununurra. That money is going to be spent on installing power generation systems and CCTV surveillance systems, and the aim is to improve traffic flow. $3 million is being allocated to help manage feral deer and pigs. A media release from State Agriculture Minister Jackie Jarvis says that money will support on-ground activities as well as research and development to reduce the impacts of these pests on our agriculture, biodiversity, social and cultural assets. What are your thoughts on that funding announcement? The text 0448 922 604. Is it enough? Is it what we need? Or is there something else that needs to be addressed? Just repeating, it's a pre-budget announcement. The state government just revealing about $26 million is going to be allocated to tackle some biosecurity threats. It is 25 to 1. Off to the Bureau of Meteorology, Caroline Crowe with you this afternoon. Caroline, what is the story for the Southwest Land Division this afternoon?
Yeah, good afternoon, Belle. Well, at the moment, we're seeing lines of showers and thunderstorms through the southwest corner. Now, some of those thunderstorms are producing quite a bit of rainfall as well. So from about midnight, there's been a couple of locations that have had just over 70 millimetres, Willie Downs and Harmon South as well. Other locations have been in that 20 to 40 millimetres. So these heavier falls are coming out of some prefrontal shower and thunderstorm lines forming ahead of a cold front that's going to move through later today and overnight. So let me backtrack a little bit. So the shower area, potentially, we've got over the whole Southwest Land Division and getting into the southwest of the goldfields as well. Those heavier showers and thunderstorms are going to be confined to the lower west, the southwest, and sort of just adjacent parts. So looking sort of around, if you draw a line from around Dongara or just south of Dongara through to Dalwallinu and down to the south coast near Albany, that's our thunderstorm area and our potential for severe thunderstorms or heavier showers and thunderstorms is from about Lancelin and south in that area, and we're experiencing that at the moment. So I mentioned those falls around 70 mils in the last 12 hours, but the thunderstorms in out of a thunderstorm, we've been getting some isolated heavier falls in that 30-minute mark or an hour mark of 20 to 40 millimetres. Through some of those. So we do have a severe weather warning out currently for a little pocket in the north of about Bunbury to Collie and sort of just south of the Mandurah area there in there potentially for that heavy rainfall. And there is heavy rainfall is the main phenomena or impact out of the thunderstorms, but that potentially we could see some large hailstones or damaging wind gusts as well. And that area there will move a little bit during the day. So earlier today it was a little bit further south. It's contracted a little bit further north. But as those thunderstorms continue to develop, we could see that area extend a little bit further south again and potentially creep up to the Perth area and Lancelin area later today. So that's what's happening at the moment. Away from the southwest corner, from about the rest of the Southwest Land Division, most parts will see around 1 to 5 millimetres. And then as that cold front moves through, it'll move along the south coast coming into the next couple of days. So today is the day where it's going to see the most weather and the heaviest rainfalls, Belle. And then coming into Friday, Saturday and Sunday, we'll see a gradual contraction of the showers more to those southern coastal districts, with the showers mostly around the south coast. And that thunderstorm area will gradually contract east along the south coast as well. So by tomorrow, the thunderstorm area is looking at being around the Esperance area. And then on Saturday, it's going to continue to move east through Saturday and Sunday and clear by Monday for the Southwest Land Division. And along the south coast after today, those rainfall totals are looking generally sort of less than about 5 millimetres, and then getting less than 1 millimetre through those adjacent inland parts, Belle.
Oh, the ones getting that rain will be just rejoicing hearing their town mentioned today. Thank you for that, Caroline. Let's have a look at northern and eastern parts now.
It's a lot quieter through those northern and eastern parts, Belle. It's generally looking at sunny and clear conditions with easterly winds through the forecast period, particularly for the Kimberley, through the interior, getting into the Pilbara and through those the southeast. There is a little bit of cloud about through central parts. Showers, as I mentioned, are creeping into the southwestern parts of the goldfields today, and then coming into tomorrow as that cold front continues to move along the south coast and those thunderstorms move east, that southwestern and southern part of the goldfields still might experience some showers and thunderstorms. The thunderstorms aren't expected to be severe after today. And then coming into Saturday, the showers would just creep into western parts of this Eucla as well and still continue potentially through those southeastern parts of the goldfields and western Eucla. And we'll see that area very similar for Sunday. And then it really contracts towards generally just that Eucla coast and only showers by Monday, Bell.
Thank you so much for going through that, Caroline. Appreciate it. 20 to 1 here on the Country Hour. Earlier in the hour, you heard from Daryl Smith, who's a potato farmer, also runs some cattle and sheep near Busselton in the state southwest. He had some great rain in the last 24 hours or so, even 24 mils this morning. So he's got a big smile on his face. But Richard Hudson, it's been a bit patchy elsewhere, hasn't it?
Yeah, particularly for the in the northern and eastern forecast districts, there's hardly anything at all. Nothing in the Kimberley, nothing in the Pilbara. In the Gascoyne, Ningen Station had 3 mils, and then nowhere else in the whole of the north and all of the east of Western Australia, there wasn't anything more than 1 mil, unfortunately. And in the Southwest Land Division forecast districts, this is only up until 9 a.m, so some places may have had a little bit more after 9 a.m, but a fair few places seem to get rain, lots of it between 1 and 4 mils. So in the central west, Binu got 6 and Yuna had between 6 and 8, but a fair few other places did get some rain. In the lower west, it was similar. So lots had between 1 and 4, but the ones above that, Huntly 5, Mandurah 5, and Mundaring also got 5, but a fair bit more in the southwest, as you heard at the start of the show. Acton Park 22, Boyne up north 17, Bridgetown 11, Bunbury 19, Busselton's Airport had 24, Cape Lewin 9, Cape Naturalist 21, Capel North 17, Chapman Hill had between 23 and 25, Collie 6 to 7 mils, Kawarram up 60, that was the most in the last 24 hours up until 9 a.m, Darden up east 12, Donnybrook had 10 to 14, Doyle Road 22, Ferguson Valley 8 to 10, Happy Valley Alert Station 19, Hentybrook 9, Jarrowood 20, Jindong 46, Kirrup 12, Logbrook 7, Ludlow 21, Manjum up 16, Mayen up south 7, Millian up 14, Nan up 27, Newbick up 7, Paindale Alert Station 10, Pemberton 14, Perryvale Orchard 10, Quinnan up 17, Ravenscliff Alert Station 8, Shannon and Thompson Brook both recorded 11, Somme Creek 9, Tonebridge 7, Vass Highway 21, Walpole Forestry 8, Warner Glen 10, Wilgarrup 15, Windy Harbour 15, and Worsley Downs 6. But as you heard from Daryl Smith earlier, he actually got a fair bit of rain after 9 a.m, which was nice. In the southern coastal region, Albany 8, Amalup 9, Bremer Bay 5, Chain Beach 6, Chillon up 8, Denbarker 7, Denmark 7 as well, King River 11, Many Peaks, Metler and Munglin up all recorded 5, and Tamar 10. And then in the central wheat belt, Beverley 6, Calgee had the same, Doodlakine and Doongan Peak 5, Gabbin 13 over 2 days, Mount Hardy 5, and York East recorded 5. And then in the Great Southern, Badgerbup 7, Boscobel 5, Brookton 7, Bullye 12, Chaming up 6, Cherry Tree 8, Colorado 6, Corrigan and Cranbrook both recorded 9, Dumbleyung 9 to 12 mils, Franklin 5, Glenrose 14, Katanning had 7 to 10 mils, Cogin up 6, Coolin 8, Lake Grace 7, Lake King 5, Maradong 7, Mordetta 8, Narrogin and Newdigate both recorded 5, Nyabing 10, Pingrup 8, Quail up 6, Riverdale 5, Wagen 10, Wickapen recorded 6, Wilgarra 5, Williams North 7, and Yealering East 6. But I reckon there's going to be a bit more tomorrow.
Yeah, I think you are right, Richard, by the sounds of things from what Caroline was saying earlier. It is 16 to 1 here on the Country Hour. It is off to Mount Barker just before the news at 1, and you'll get the results of today's cattle market. First, though, an Australian resources company has revealed its plan to be the first to use Lake Argyle's hydroelectricity project in the East Kimberley since the closure of the Argyle diamond mine back in 2020. Kimberley reporter Alice Marshall is following the story. Alice, tell us about the company behind this plan.
Afternoon, Belle. Yeah, so we're talking about Tivan, which is a Darwin-based critical minerals company. So far, they actually haven't mined anything, but they do have plans to open what will be Australia's first commercial fluorite mine. It's going to be here southwest of Kununurra, and it's for that planned fluorite mine that they want to harness that Ord River hydropower for.
And that Ord Hydro project, it's not a new project. That's infrastructure that's been in place for decades now. Why is a commercial proposal like this one only coming up at this point?
Yeah, as you mentioned there, it's decades old. It was built way back in 1997 to harness the flow of water coming out of Lake Argyle. Of course, Lake Argyle was dammed a couple of decades before 1997. They had all that water flowing through underneath that dam wall, basically not going to waste because it was going down the Ord River, but it wasn't being used for hydropower until they built that plant back in 1997. And that coincided with the use of that power for predominantly the Argyle diamond mine. It was also at that stage planning to, and it has continued to, supply the Kimberley towns of Kununurra, where I'm sitting now, and Wyndham. Wyndham, of course, has a tiny population and Kununurra's not very big either. So most of that electricity was going into the Argyle diamond mine, which, of course, closed in 2020. And so for the past more than four years now, that power has been sitting unused, or it's been flowing through the river unused, up to 15 megawatts of unused power. And Tivan has seen this unutilised power, and they've looked at the location of their proposed mine site, which they call their Speewar project, in proximity to where that old diamond mine sits, and they saw an opportunity there, as their CEO Grant Wilson explains.
So the Ord River hydro infrastructure was put together 30, 40 years ago, ostensibly to power Kununurra and Wyndham. So you could think of 10 to 15 megawatts of renewable energy there, and then 10 to 15 megawatts to power the famous Argyle diamond mines, which is down near Speewar. There's a transmission corridor which runs south along the Lake Argyle. And Argyle's diamond mine was decommissioned, is in the process of being decommissioned. And so there's now scope for Speewar to effectively take that same, what is now redundant capacity, through the existing transmission corridor and build some additional transmission to the west to pick up some Indigenous communities, which is very important for this sort of initiative, and then ultimately to power Speewar.
Grant Wilson, who is the CEO of Tivan. And Alice, what exactly is that Speewar project going to look like?
So as I touched on earlier, Bill, it's going to be a fluorite mine. And it's probably worth noting here that if you're not quite familiar with what fluorite is, you're not alone. It's a very little known critical mineral. Actually, when I spoke to some experts about it back in January when Tivan announced that they were going to be mining it, those experts said they had to get out their periodic table to go and flip back through and re-familiarise themselves. It's currently not mined in Australia. It's only mined in places like China, Mongolia, Mexico and South Africa. But it's had a bit of recognition in Australia since it was added to our critical minerals list in December. And that's essentially why Tivan went and had a look to see if they had capacity to mine it, which they do. And they've jumped on that capacity. And that's because the price of fluorite's been going through the roof. It's got roles in EV batteries and semiconductors and all those things that we're using more and more going forward. So Tivan are currently working on frantically pulling together their pre-feasibility study for their Speewar project, hopefully ready by July. They're going through all those works, and they've also proposed a deal with the operators of the Port of Wyndham to export their product out of there. So between that and the proposed extension of these power lines and the hydropower going through them, it would mean a lot of local jobs. But like any project in the Kimberley, there's always a pretty fair degree of wariness when it comes to these projects actually getting to fruition. They do call it a bit of the land of the white elephant. But with this one, there's plenty of hope too, which is something that I spoke to the president of the Shire of East Kimberley and Wyndham, David Menzel, about.
Absolutely a great opportunity for economic development, regional development, and to see the resource that Tyvan's involved with, which we know is a significant size and potentially offers some very long-term operations. Look, to see that come to fruition, that resource has been known about for a long time, but we've yet to see anyone being able to commercialise it. So seeing these sorts of plans come forward and the opportunities they might raise for local employment and development between the local community down around Doondoon with Cunanara as a service and also the Port of Wyndham, I mean, it's just a fantastic opportunity if we can get this thing over the line.
Shire of Wyndham East Kimberley President David Menzel and Alice Marshall, thank you for bringing us that story today.
My pleasure. Thanks, Bill.
Cunanara-based rural reporter Alice Marshall telling you about that Darwin-based critical minerals company Tyvan, which has plans to harness that Ord River hydropower and open the only commercial fluorite mine in the country just southwest of Cunanara. 10 to 1 here on the Country Hour. Well, not only the price of fluorite's been going up recently, gold has also been going through the roof in the last few months. And now there's speculation silver could be next. As Tara de Landgraft explains, that could be good news for Australia's mining industry.
The price of silver has risen 18% in the last 6 months and is now worth more than 40 Aussie dollars per troy ounce. And that's got macroeconomic analysts like Luke Groman interested in what it could do next.
I'm bullish on silver. I think it will be a monetary metal for the masses. In terms of the fiscal situation of the reserve currency issuer, the U.S., and the West more broadly, I think gold will play the primary role there simply because silver is not on the central bank's balance sheet. And so I don't think central banks will buy silver simply because of the industrial use. In other words, if they did so, particularly in the context of global climate, EV electrification initiatives, it would be highly counterproductive for them to try to deflate sovereign debt against silver, because now you're talking about taking silver to prices that make solar panels uneconomic relative to fossil fuels, that make iPhones uneconomic relative to masses of the people, and they create an inflation problem and make it worse. Silver is actually used for something. I think gold will serve a role of devaluing or deflating debt on central bank balance sheets, recapping them. I think silver will benefit immensely. I think silver will serve as a monetary metal for the masses. But that's how I think about the two of them vis-a-vis central banks.
Macroeconomic analyst Luke Groman speaking at a webinar a few weeks ago. And while Mr. Groman doesn't think central banks will be buying silver, Canadian billionaire and investor Eric Sprott has suggested who might.
All that time that I was involved with gold and silver, I always thought the markets were manipulated, the precious metals markets. And there's lots of evidence of that. Subsequently, we had a recent situation, actually literally in the last week, where apparently China has come out in advertisements on TV suggesting that their citizens should buy silver rather than gold. Now that is a rather dramatic, could be a rather dramatic thing when you think of the 1.4 billion people over there all buying silver, of which there is already a shortage.
Well, Australia has the largest share of the world's economic silver resources, mostly in Queensland, the NT and South Australia. But mines right across the nation have silver as part of their overall commodity mix. Warren Pierce from the Association of Mining and Exploration Companies says it's time for the metal to ride on the coattails of its rich cousin gold.
If you look at the price, it started to spike probably for the best it's been in 3 years. So certainly it's getting a lot more attention than it has, but really it hasn't been a huge focus of industry. Just doesn't ever seem to get the love. However, that said, there are some interesting projects around the country looking at the silver market, and indeed you've seen some spikes in interest in Asia in terms of investment and interest in being or looking at those types of projects as a secondary option for than gold. And I don't think it's ever going to replace gold, but I do think at the kind of spike it's seeing now, you're going to see some people start to turn their minds to how they might be able to take advantage of that.
In Western Australia's historic goldfields mining region, Maury Goods says the time is right for silver. The resource industry stalwart was once head of a company hoping to bring a silver super pit to Kalgoorlie. He said the current increasing price and interest in the precious metal is encouraging for current miners and may bring fresh interest to old projects.
Inevitably, I think the silver price had to return to a more realistic level. So it is good to see that the price has recovered in recent times. Silver price tends to vary much more than the gold price. So the gold price has incrementally crept up, whereas the silver price has spiked up to the point of being, you know, nearly 100% higher than it was a couple of years ago. So it's, you know, it's taken an amazing leap. And that's an important thing for the companies that have silver assets and you know, what they're contemplating for the future.
Given some of those external factors, the exchange rate, obviously some instability in a number of countries, do you feel like it is that time that people with silver assets should be potentially reassessing their viability, Maury? Does it feel like that's the time?
I always recommend that the time is before the surge happens, but without doubt, we have a current world economic situation that sees precious and critical minerals only increasing in value. And so anyone who's got an asset in critical or precious metals, and that includes silver and gold, now is a good time to really be looking at those assets and saying, you know, should we be reassessing them? Should we be giving the green light to those projects we have assessed and they've just been on care and maintenance? Should we be looking at investment potential partners who want to develop these? If, you know, if it's a company that's needing capital, and then now's a good time to be considering those questions.
WA Resource Industries stalwart Maury Goods speaking to Tara DeLandgraf. You can read more about that story. It's online for you now. Just search ABC Rural and Silver for Tara's story. 1:03. Well, the bidding war over Australia's largest cotton processor, Namoi Cotton, continues, with Olam Agri Holdings announcing today it's going to increase its off-market takeover offer for the company. Earlier this week, the Louis Dreyfus Company, which already owns 17% of Namoi Cotton, increased its own bid to acquire the remaining 83% of shares. Director of the Rural Economies Centre for Excellence, Ben Lyons, says the back and forth bidding reflects the attractiveness of Australian agricultural assets to overseas investors.
Australian agriculture is a pretty, wouldn't say heavily invested, but it's attracted interest at varying times from foreign investors, whether they be Canadian or overseas superannuation funds or the like. And it's a, you know, as far as international agriculture goes, Australia has a lot of, there's a lot of benefits for investing in Australian ag, and cotton just one of those.
Ben Lyons, he's the Director of Rural Economies Centre for Excellence at the University of Southern Queensland, speaking to David Chen. 1:02 to the markets now, and 1,404 head of cattle sold at Mount Barker today. So a very similar size yarding to last week. Tracy Kilner's at the sale yards now. Hello, Tracy. What were the prices like today?
Hi, Belinda. Definitely prices fluctuated on quality. Feeder buyers were chasing weights, paying to 3.28 for steer weaners and up to 2.88 for the heavyweight heifers. Trade steers sold up to 2.50, while quality heifers made up to 2.60 a kilo. Heavy cows remained firm, while heavy bulls regained last fortnight's fall. Weaner steers sold from 134 to 3.28, and heifers made from 76 to 288 cents a kilo. Yearling steers returned 160 to 316 cents, and the heifers from 180 to 280 cents a kilo. Grown steers sold at 250 cents, while the grown heifers weighing under 540 kilos made from 168 to 260, and the heavier weights returned 210 to 226 cents a kilo. Heavy cows sold from 150 to 194 cents, while store cows continued to rise, selling from 115 to 174 cents a kilo. Heavy bulls made from 140 to 198, and medium weights gained, selling from 150 to 200 cents a kilo. This has been Tracy Kilner for Meat and Livestock Australia's National Livestock Reporting Service.
Tracy, thank you so much for going through those details. Good to talk to you today. The 1 o'clock news is next.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.